This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
I am Elizabeth Anderson. It's the second week of the month, and so it's the Santa Maria Radio Book Club. I am here with fellow radio host Philip Hooser, and we have very special guests today. And before we get Christopher Bram and William Sterling Walker on the phone, just want to do a quick thank you to some important donors who have already given to support the show. And I also want to thank my co-host, Philip Hooser, who is my substitute host, only he's really a full-fledged host of the Santa Maria Radio Book Club, because I'm traveling a bit to Canada, and he does a wonderful job of hosting the Santa Moran Radio Book Club when I can't, and I appreciate it.
Well, I think of myself as the sub-ho.
I believe we have on the line Christopher Bram and William Sterling Walker. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Elizabeth. This is Chris.
Will?
Hi, this is Will.
I thought today we're going to be talking the first half of the hour about Gods and Monsters, originally titled Father of Frankenstein, and the second half of the show about eminent outlaws. But I usually start with a general question, just kind of an icebreaker. And I want to ask, what are your favorite genres to read when you're not writing and you're relaxing? Will, I'll start with you.
I read a lot of literary fiction, but I do occasionally read mysteries. Patricia Highsmith or John Le Carré, I read him. So right now I'm reading on a Henry James kick. So I'm reading, I just finished The American, and I'm about to start his first novel, Watch and Ward.
Oh, that's wonderful. From John Le Carré to Henry James.
Henry James, yes.
Suggest some breadth to your reading. And Chris, what about you?
Oh, I read a lot of literary fiction, but in addition to that, history and biography. I love reading good history and good biography. And it could be anybody, biographies of writers in particular, but also historical figures. Been rereading a terrific two-volume biography of all people, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, by Richard Holmes. And he's just such a great, larger-than-life character, this great talker who was also addicted to opium. And this is the author of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And it sounds kind of nerdy and college academic, but it's actually a lot of fun. It's a very funny, entertaining biography.
I'm making a note now. And Philip and I talk quite a bit about things that we read. But Philip, why don't you tell our listeners some favorite genres?
Oh, I'm very much a mystery fan myself. I go for cozies mostly. I've been reading the Patrick Quinn series about a detective, a private detective, who solves crimes with his dog, and the dog is the narrator. And he's a very credible dog narrator as well.
Well, I would agree with literary fiction, and I do enjoy very much nonfiction and memoirs. I thought I wasn't very fond of science fiction or fantasy, but for this book club, I read all sorts of things. And so on the 29th, we have a show about two novels that are climate fiction, just brilliantly written. I'm delighted to have you all here, and why don't we talk about Gods and Monsters, which was originally titled Father of Frankenstein. Chris, would you mind telling us about the title first?
Well, I wrote the book as Father of Frankenstein. It's a novel about the movie director James Whale, who made the original Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, as well as The Invisible Man and The Old Dark House. British, came to California in the 1930s, worked for his whole life in Hollywood, and died a very mysterious death. And so my novel was a way to explore that and explore him. And I want to call it Father of Frankenstein. It's a kind of almost homage to Bride of Frankenstein, Son of Frankenstein, House of Frankenstein, all the sequels that were made. But then when it came time to make the movie, Bill Condon, who directed it, also wrote the screenplay, and he loved the title Father of Frankenstein. Brendan Fraser was to be cast in it. And Brendan, as the yard man, Clay Boone, Brendan did not like the title Father of Frankenstein. He said it sounded like a B picture. And Bill tried to explain that was the point. Brendan wouldn't have any of that. So Bill came up with the title Gods and Monsters, which is actually a line from Bride of Frankenstein, with Dr. Pretorius' toast to a new world of gods and monsters. And I said, that's a great title. It works. So ever since, the book has become known as Father Frankenstein, Basis for the Movie Gods and Monsters. And then after a while, we decided, oh, let's just call the book Gods and Monsters.
If I had been asked to guess who created the title of the film, I would never, ever have guessed Brendan Fraser.
Yep, he was the one pushing for it. And we're still not sure why he had just finished George of the Jungle and Airheads. And my theory is, if he was going to be a serious movie, it better have a serious title.
A question that I want to ask each one of you is, do you find that in different phases of your life, books and themes, they hit you differently? And I'll give an example. When I was 18, I was in a comparative literature English course, and I had to read Death in Venice by Thomas Mann, which I didn't get at all. I thought it was boring and pointless. I didn't understand any of it. And then later, maybe 5-6 years later, I was teaching poetry, including The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot, and ding, 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 a few bells went off. But I have to say that this novel really brought me into the mind of someone who is facing mortality. And I'll ask Philip this next. Are there books and themes that have struck you that way differently?
Oh, absolutely. I recently had cause to reread Watership Down, which I hadn't read since I was a child. And I realize now how much, certainly the politics of it, I had missed. Or maybe it's the effect of there being more totalitarian governments closer to home, but it certainly influenced the way I looked at and read that book. And every time I reread Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum, I find it has these different layers for me, reading it about every 10 years or so.
And Will, what about you?
Well, I'm sitting here thinking about Chris's book, The Father of Frankenstein, and the whole sequence when James Whale remembers his service in the First World War, and how fascinating that was to read and to be in his mind about that. But also, I recently reread Death in Venice about 3 months ago, and it was quite an experience for me because I didn't remember half the things in it the first time I read it, which was in college. And I had remembered it mostly visually from the opera, and it was a very interesting reading experience. I haven't read too much about death lately. I'm not concerned about my mortality these days, but...
Chris, what about you?
It's fascinating to reread books you've read before because you get to revisit the book, but you're also revisiting who you were back when you first read it and kind of understanding what you could see and what you couldn't. I teach writing at the Gallatin School at NYU, at New York University, and we just did this semester The Great Gatsby, which we're supposed to be looking at it just for technique and style and not as the content. But all the students were all kind of going, we first read this back in high school. We didn't understand it. Why it was a mistake to give us this book in high school? We read it in this very simple, romantic way. Mm-hmm. And so you reread the book now, and you see that old romantic self. But you also see all the kind of the dark side, the kind of the critical side, the questions Fitzgerald raises. And it's a much richer, more complex book than any high school student would be able to understand. But it's fun to kind of revisit it and see the different layers. As you get older, you are reading it as you are now, older and wiser, one hopes, but also looking back to your more innocent self.
And Will mentioned he wasn't thinking much about mortality, and I'm not so much for myself, but a dear friend died last month. She was in her 80s.
I'm sorry.
And my parents are 93 and 95 and in their own home. As I read your book, it really brought home to me why my father is telling me quite a bit about World War II and being in the Army Signal Corps. And Philip, I think you had the same experience I did reading about the World War I flashbacks.
Oh, very much. It was so vivid, it made me itchy.
We have the National World War I Memorial, the Liberty Memorial, here in Kansas City. And just going down into those trenches that they have built so that you can feel being down there. Of course, they don't give you the true experience of the lice and the filth. But it's still, it's just awful to think of being stranded in that mud and mire for years.
Yeah.
And Chris, you did a wonderful job of describing that.
Well, thank you. One of the things that drew me to James Whale's story was, I mean, I knew his movies, and but then when I learned he fought in the trenches in the First World War, I thought, wow, that gives a whole new element to the stories, to the movies, to the jokes about death he makes in the movie. These were not just jokes. He was writing out of his own personal experience, and I wanted to make that a very important part of the story. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the First World War and about how the writing about it. I mean, there's so much good writing about World War I. Amazing book of literary criticism by Paul Fussell called The Great War and Modern Memory. And he talks about the poets, the novelists, all these people writing about the war in a way that makes it very vivid. You are there when you're... It's rare to read a book of literary criticism that makes you actually... put you in the shoes of people.
I think one poet, I hope I'm correct, was Siegfried Sassoon.
He's a major character in this book,
I think it rings so true that past events are ever present as one ages. I find myself thinking back, you know, in my case, to the 60s, 70s. And he talks about his first sexual experience with Tozer. I'm just wondering, Will, what relevance you think that has to the plot of the book?
Well, I think it's extremely relevant.
Well, can I jump in?
Yes, please. As a gay man, I was also attracted to the story of James Whale because he was gay, but as I was writing it, I realized it's just one element in his life. It's not this dominating element. That probably the First World War is more important.
Right.
Although, in the First World War, his being gay would enable him to kind of connect with, as an officer, he would have this feeling of empathy or love for his men. But actually, I think straight men probably did too at the time, but he was probably more in touch with that. And so the memories of his first love when he was a young man, later on the memories of his kind of bonding with...
Barnett,
thank you. Yeah,
Barnett.
The character Barnett. Very important elements of who he was. And not just the sexuality per se, but the emotion, his feeling for his fellow men.
Well, and also being in the compression and tension of the trenches, too, I think that heightened everything as well, because there was so much fear and emotion around that, and even the morbidity and how they responded to that. With the grimness, the grim humor.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that kind of culminates in that whole sequence with Barnett on the wire, you know. But, yeah, I mean, when I think of the sexuality, I guess it's less sexuality than emotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the camaraderie, I guess, too.
My first knowledge of James Whale actually came from Hollywood Babylon, but that made me more fascinated with him and sought out all of his movies. And I think that what you did, Chris, was create this wonderful mosaic of all of those experiences that then I was able to take away and have, just within the space of the last year, rewatched many of his films, many of Whale's films. And I could see, okay, this is the dark, how to face life humor that got him through, and this you can interpret as being the artist side and this the gay part, and you could see all of that just blending together into making what I think are some incredibly artistically made films.
So I agree. Thank you. Yeah, no, he was a man of many sides, and in his best movies you get to see all those different sides, which is very exciting.
And when that young reporter comes to interview him, I think of him as a twit. Edmund Kay.
He wasn't rich, huh? Yeah.
He just keeps bringing it back to the same theme. Here's James Whale thinking, but I did Showboat.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps we've all talked to those young journalists. It's maddening to have an interview and it's single track. It's absolutely single track. And one of the things I loved about this book is it could have been grim. I mean, here's a director in the later stages of his life, and he's having hallucinations and flashbacks and fog from medication. And it could have been pretty sad, but his sardonic humor, we hear his thoughts. I have to congratulate you, Chris. The humor carries the book because it makes the other passages, they shine.
Oh, well, thank you. No, and the humor in Whale's movies, I think, shines too. I mean, there's a lot of gallows humor in, I mean, Bride of Frankenstein is a comedy.
Oh, yes.
For all its grimness, and he's having a lot of fun with it. And it's still serious underneath it. The horror still comes through, but actually it's a comedy about death, which I think the character Whale says at one point in the novel. I couldn't find him actually saying that in real life, but his movies are often very funny. Invisible Man is very... The Old Dark House is hysterical.
Oh,
it's like the precursor to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and very, very funny. I think I've seen that. I don't think I've... Oh, check it out. It appears in better and better prints as time goes on, and it has a great cast. Boris Karloff.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Laughton shows up. Gloria Stewart, who is later in Titanic, is in it. It's a pretty amazing movie.
And she was very beautiful.
She was very beautiful back then, yeah.
And in that movie, he sets up all of the tropes that we still see today in all of the haunted house movies.
We're still using them, yeah. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of, we've taken so much from that movie, yeah.
There's a line, I made note of it, I was reading the Father Frankenstein edition. Whale watches him stroll over to the pool and greet a gaggle of executives, the bald little man who shared his bed for 20 years, referring to David Lewis. It's as peculiar as seeing that bed appear at a party and watching it chat with strangers. That was just a wonderful indication of how distance occurs in relationships. And you think, were we ever close?
I confess, I got a little unfair to David Lewis in the book. He and Whale were partners for many years. They did kind of break up at one point. And I had them breaking up over Lewis being in the closet. In fact, Lewis was pretty open. But I needed a fall guy. I needed somebody to contrast with James Whale. I mean, David Lewis is a famous story about he was called into Jack Warner's office. He was working at Warner Brothers. And Jack Warner asked him, do you have to live with Mr. Whale? And he replied, I don't have to live with Mr. Whale. I want to live with Mr. Whale. So he was fairly open. And Hollywood at this time was a small town. Everybody knew who was gay and who wasn't. It was like one big office. So I needed somebody in the closet, so I made David Lewis the closeted gay man. And I feel a little guilty about that, but it was. I was fun to come up with lines like the one you just quoted, Elizabeth, about the strangeness of seeing your bed appear at a party or somebody representing your bed. That was a lot of fun to write.
I imagine it must have been fun too to write the scenes where he's driving Elsa and Charles Laughton around Hollywood for the first time and showing them the sights and introducing them to mayonnaise.
So that was fun. But it's kind of fun going back in time and imagining all these actors who we know from their films, we've heard stories, and then so what were they really like? What was the conversation with them like? It's kind of one of the challenges for any writer.
And the party scene is really a tour de force as far as that's concerned. I mean, you bring the whole cast together in that way with Princess Margaret.
With Princess Margaret, yes.
I could almost see Vanessa Kirby now redoing it.
Well, even I earlier were talking about The Crown and how much we enjoy it, and seeing these real-life characters brought to life by first-rate actors and actresses.
But that whole sequence in the way Bill Condon filmed it, too, it was there. It was already there on the page, but it was a great experience to see it. I remember seeing the first cut over at Ed's house without the score yet, and how fascinating it was. And I loved the party scene. The party scene is great, especially with George Cukor and his arrival there and meeting Princess Margaret.
I was very lucky. I fell in the hands of really talented people, and I loved the movie, which not all authors can say. Often authors are frustrated by what's happened in their movie. Not me. I'm delighted with what happened.
Again, I just have to echo, I think that is such a beautifully executed scene in the film version. And it is just gorgeous and hilarious. And yet it makes me feel so deeply for all of the characters. Plus, I'm a Cukor fan, I'll have to admit. So having him there was a delight for me.
In the film, for me, it was such a shock to see Lynn Redgrave in that role. I think she did a wonderful job, but at first I had a little trouble getting past, that's Lynn Redgrave.
And she wanted to play that role, and she wanted to make her strange and foreign, and this is very funny. A friend of mine watched the movie with Lynn for the first time with Lynn Redgrave's mother, and when it was over, Lynn Redgrave's mother said, "I like that very much. Where were you, my dear?" She did not recognize her own daughter in that role.
Magnificent.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
But now I want to get to another book by the author who has joined us on the air, Christopher Bram. And we have William Sterling Walker also on the air to join Philip and me. And we're going to talk about Eminent Victorians, the Gay Writers Who Changed America. Chris, would you talk
about Eminent Outlaws.
What did I say?
Eminent Victorians. I know what you were thinking.
I know what I was thinking. I was thinking of Lytton Strachey's Eminent Victorians.
That was always in our mind.
And I'm probably one of the few lesbians who not only has read Eminent Victorians, but owns it. So.
You're definitely getting us Bloomsburyed in this.
I want to ask you, Chris, where you did come up with the title.
We needed a title. I mean, the subtitle is The Gay Writers Who Changed America. And that was all, we always had that, right? The first title I pitched to them was Rewriting America. And they didn't like that for some reason. And then, I forget who, somebody kind of came up with something outlaws. And, well, we kept kind of doing different combinations until we finally hit upon Eminent Outlaws. We realized that's it. We all agreed it was the first, because it makes you think of the Lytton Strachey book, Eminent Victorians. It makes you think of John Retchie's book, The Sexual Outlaw. And it just kind of covered the bases, and it was kind of short and simple, and people can remember it. So, and if they confuse it sometimes with Eminent Victorians, that's a good confusion to have.
Absolutely.
I love Eminent Victorians. I've taught it for a writing class, and because it's biography, but it's also very funny.
I don't know Eminent Victorians, but I do know Elizabeth and Essex, and it is one of my favorite biographies in all of literature. And Strachey is just such a wonderful writer.
Very funny, smart, and kind of connecting things together. The book was published during the First World War, and Eminent Victorians was, and it was a big hit in the trenches. People would read it in the trenches.
Wow.
Well, one of my favorite Lytton Strachey anecdotes, Philip has heard this, is he had to go before the military board. He was saying he was a conscientious objector. And they said, well, what if your sister was being molested? And he said, I would interpose myself between them, which I just thought, that was so Lytton. But let's get back to your book. I love the tagline, the gay revolution began as a literary revolution. Philip, thoughts?
I think absolutely, and I think even more so, having read this. You know, it was always the thing as a young gay boy, I was out looking for, where are my stories? Again, our stories. Where is the tradition that I can fit into as a writer? I wish this book had been around then, you know, in the 1860s when I was growing up. Just kidding. It's the 1850s. Trying to make myself a little younger. But it absolutely puts a lot of things in the perspective of where literature had been heading and how they were able to create disruptions and waves in that and then get slapped back down, so then the next wave has to come again.
Will, any thoughts to add?
Just that I was always looking for my story as well, and my first encounter with gay literature was when I was 18, just starting college, and a close friend of mine had a paperback copy with the Mel Odom cover of Nocturnes for the King of Naples and by Edmund White. And we were in his bedroom in his childhood home, and he found it there. We were picking up some albums and things from his house to take to his apartment, and he literally tossed the book to me and said, "Here, read this." And it sort of opened up a whole world for me to read gay writing. It was always, for me, about writing and reading stories.
Chris, what about you?
Oh, I mean, I make the joke. It isn't really a joke. I read my way out of the closet. Philip, I'm very bookish, and that was kind of always my books were my way to connect with the world and to discover new worlds I wasn't sure about where they existed. For me, one of the big revelations was I was working in a Boy Scout camp, and somebody had a book of essays by Leslie Fiedler. And he has a famous essay called Come Back to the Raft, Huck Honey, published in 1949. And where he argued that a major theme in American literature is the young white male running off to the wilderness in the arms of his dusty lover. Mm. And I thought, wow, it gave a whole new meaning to my crushes on other boys. It meant I was, had something in common with Huck Finn. It was quite a revelation. But it made me realize that it's not perverted. It's very human. It's part of American literature, which gave me some solid ground to stand on.
What you said, not perverted. What struck me reading the book was the catch-22 that so many of these writers, authors, playwrights, poets found themselves caught up in. They were slammed for gay content that critics saw as disgusting and deviant. And then they were slammed for their straight portraits being inauthentic. And I thought you presented that very well.
Mm-hmm. No, they couldn't win. It was quite strange. And it's one of the challenges to writing this book was I had to read all this reviews from the period. And the hatred, the contempt was just, I mean, I knew it was out there, but to read it from supposedly intelligent, literate people, men and women, one after another, it was numbing after a while. I mean, I could quote some of that, but I did not come close to quoting all of it. It really wore me down after a while.
Somewhat analogous, James Baldwin was criticized for not being black enough by some readers and being too black by other readers. Again, a no-win situation. And
yeah.
We should probably mention some of the authors that you cover in the book. Gore Vidal, James Baldwin, Allen Ginsberg, Tennessee Williams, Truman Capote, Christopher Isherwood, Edward Albee, Edmund White, Armistead Maupin, Larry Kramer, Tony Kushner, Michael Cunningham, and I probably forgot a few. How did you decide which authors to include and which wouldn't be right for this book?
I just basically followed my nose, to be honest. There were a few I knew I definitely would cover. And I kind of put, when I wrote my book proposal, I kind of pitched most of the writers you just mentioned. Except, strangely enough, in my original proposal, I did not mention Christopher Isherwood. And it was only when I wrote the book chronologically. I began at the beginning with 1949 and all these books that came out at the same time. But then I get to Gore Vidal Goes to Hollywood, and he meets Christopher Isherwood. And I thought, oh, I need to add something more about Christopher Isherwood here. And I kept adding more and more. And he's actually my favorite person in the book. I mean, I knew Isherwood's work. I loved A Single Man, the stories that became the movie Cabaret, Down There on the Visit, the later autobiography Christopher and His Kind. They're part of my blood. I mean, they are. But I hadn't stopped to realize how important he was until I was actually telling the story and saw how he fit in it. He's one of the few writers of the older generation who was interested in the younger generation. He was supportive. He became friends with them. He's also one of the few writers of that older generation who kept his sanity. He did not give in to alcohol or drugs. And he kind of kept both feet on the ground. And part of this was because of his exploration of Vedanta. He was a very spiritual person. He also had his partner, Don Bacardi. They were very close and very supportive of each other. They fought, like couples often fight, but they were still always there for each other. And I think that kept him sane. That was a really necessary part of who he was.
Well, I also have to say that in light of a play that I did last December about one of the authors in your book, I was hoping that there could have been more Capote because he fascinates me.
No, he is fascinating. He was an incredibly talented writer from early on.
Oh, yes.
And one of the pleasures of writing this book was rereading Capote and just seeing how good he was. It was also sad to realize at a certain point after In Cold Blood, how he fell apart.
Yes.
It's kind of painful to read about and to follow. But I mean, his Other Voices, Other Rooms, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and In Cold Blood, these are really major, major books that we still go back to. I've taught a couple of them, and my students still respond to them. They're still fresh.
And even some of his shorter works, like Grass Harp and even House of Flowers, the play, I think, for their faults, there's still so much beauty and lyricism in them.
Yeah, no, just genuinely gifted writer, amazing writer. I mean, even early on, Gore Vidal, so insanely jealous of Truman Capote, found a letter where he's complaining, I wasn't literary the way Truman was right from the start. I mean, he recognized Truman was a better writer at the beginning of their careers.
I don't think I'd have cared to spend a lot of time with Gore Vidal.
Well, okay, another pleasure for me writing this book was going back to younger Gore Vidal when he was more generous, less acerbic, more supportive of his friends. And that was kind of, I'd forgotten about it, because Gore Vidal, in the last 20 years of his life,
right,
was a real jerk. And not good company. But when he was younger, like, he was good company. He would help his friends. He wasn't so competitive. Drink hadn't turned him into a monster. Yeah.
One of the parts of the book that really hit home for me, because I'm of a certain age, is the AIDS crisis. I remember when friends were going to funerals just about every week. And I think it's the New York Times this is from. Without organized repression or without a virus more deadly than any cultural enemy, there may still be new books by gay writers, but no unifying storyline, no outlaws. I tend to disagree with that statement. What do you think, Will?
You disagree.
I disagree.
Yeah. And it's, for a lot many people, when AIDS came along, it kind of, oh, here's the real gay story. Well, it's not.
Yeah. It's not. And there were so many stories. There were so many different stories. I mean, there were also stories of survival, you know, of love and companionship and taking care of your own and taking care of business and going on and some survivor guilt, but also, you know, keep it going, keep the culture going.
I like what you just said very much.
Thank you.
First thing, I think that both a repressive culture and the closet and all of those things can create one type of culture, and that being authentic and open and living your life can create another type of culture. And I think that, you know, there are people who are nostalgic for one and not the other, and there are people now who are going, oh, kids don't even come out these days, get off my lawn, you trans kids, and all of that. And I have to think, it's all just happening. Just watch what happens and be a part of it if you want to, and don't be a part if you don't.
And I really don't think there is such a thing as post-gay fiction or post-LGBT fiction. I think we'll always have our stories. They'll change, they'll evolve, but we'll always have stories. Chris?
Oh, yeah, no, I agree. And there's certain stories we share. We all have to come out. Straight people don't have to worry about that, but we do. And it's kind of a very simple but primal story that often embarrasses us. We have our different challenges as a minority group, as any minority group has. To go back briefly to AIDS, William has written about AIDS in his short stories. He did a really nice collection of short stories, Desire Tales of New Orleans,
yes,
about a circle of friends in New Orleans, and AIDS is present there, but it's kind of just they're dealing with it. It's part of the grief. And it's grief, everybody, you don't have to be gay to experience to lose someone close to you.
Mm.
Right, and it's a grief that pervades, and yet you must go on. You must go on. The 80s were a difficult time for all of us, and I lost a good many friends. I lost the best friend. I wrote about him in Boys Like Us. Coming out stories, but you move on and you remember. It's always about memory, and you keep that memory alive of your loved ones, and you carry them with you.
Well, I saw you at Saints and Sinners, the literary festival in New Orleans,
yes,
in late March,
yes,
and I believe that you were in the AIDS panel, Stories from the AIDS Era.
I wasn't on the panel, no, but I was there. I was there and listening. Yes.
I thought those stories and poems and remarks were so moving, and I think it's important for younger people to hear.
Yes. Yes, and it's important because as survivors of the crisis, we are the bridge with the next generation. And that's something that I've been thinking about a lot. The older generation lost the middle bridge with so many people in the AIDS crisis to my generation. And so a whole era was kind of wiped out of culture, and it's kind of hard for the culture to transmit when that bridge between generations is gone. But now that the crisis has abated somewhat, I think it's important that we carry forward, because to the younger people that we remain a bridge.
That makes very good sense.
Yeah. Absolutely, and I know a lot of people who feel more responsibility to pass on, this is our history, these are our people, these are our stories, so that young people do know you are part of this wonderful tradition of, you know, Uncle Walt's and Auntie Gertrude's, and we're all going to move forward together.
Chris, one of the
Absolutely.
Things I appreciated most about your book was that it wasn't just chronological. It was thematic as well, and I thought your themes were thoughtfully chosen.
Okay, well, themes just kind of naturally came up, and it's nonfiction, but it was like writing a novel. I would follow one character for a while, and then he'd meet another character. And I'd, let's see what happens if I follow him, and things would come up. And a lot of it was I was working out of my unconscious, just as I do when I'm writing fiction. Mm-hmm. Well, and also, too, you know, you could Venn diagram that book. It's all about relationship. I mean, it really is. Most of the people that you mention are connected multiple ways to the next person.
Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth, you asked earlier how I chose the people, and often it would be if they knew each other, if they met, if they were friends, they got in. They were in the. There are a few isolated writers I didn't know how to work into the story because they never met. But early on, I said I did not want to do an index card history. I wanted to follow just eight people more crowded in. It couldn't help but happen. But it's a very social history, because I think gay literature in particular, maybe all literature, is very social.
Right. Right.
And I would like to thank Will. I think he's given me a theme for book club. Books you can Venn diagram and books you can't.
Well, Rachel Cohen wrote a book about American and British literature of the 20th century, and it's basically A meets B, B meets C, A meets D, meets, yeah. And she has in a
what is the name of it? Meeting, brief meetings, encounters, or I can't remember the title, but on the in the hardcover edition, she actually has her diagrams of the characters and how they knew each other, and they're like little circles. It's sort of akin to doing a family tree, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a really fascinating book.
Yeah, very much like the Whispered Transmission.
Exactly like the Whispered Transmission. Yeah.
We're a little bit short on time, but I just want to mention that I met you both initially in New York City at the Publishing Triangle Awards, and had a chance to talk briefly with both of you at the reception. And this is kind of embarrassing on myself, but I asked Carol Rosenfeld later, I said, "Who's this Chris Bram I'm friends with on Facebook?" And she said, "Christopher Bram, Gods and Monsters." I said, "Oh my God, I've seen that film 3 times." Yeah, I felt a bit ashamed. But I do want to add.
Why? Authors are kind of like we're behind the scenes. I mean, it's. I would. Another book of Chris's that I would recommend is Gossip.
Okay, making a note.
It's called Gossip. It's about politics in Washington.
Oh, wonderful. You already have me at Washington.
You had me at Gossip.
Well, can you tell we team often on the radio?
You make a good team. You do make a good team.
I do want to ask how readers could find out more about you, both Chris and William, since you're an author as well. So, Chris, I'll start with you.
I mean, just Google me. It's Christopher Brand, and there's a Wikipedia entry. I've done interviews, and that kind of. It's amazing what you can find online. It's wonderful. It's so much easier now than it used to be. I have a website, www.williamsterlingwalker.com. That's where I am. And I also have my art on the website, too, because I'm an artist. I do collage. He's a wonderful collages. I've got you. Thank you. Me a couple of his collages. They're beautiful. Thank you.
And he has, I believe, 2, right, of the cutest dogs I've ever seen.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I'm on Facebook. I think my Facebook profile's settings are pretty lax and loose, so you can find me there. And I friend people. I have a diverse friendship on Facebook.
See now I'm making
I'm a
note.
I'm a liker of Facebook.
I'm making a note. William Sterling Walker, fast and loose.
I knew he wasn't going to let that go. I knew for a fact. Chris, you occasionally attend Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, don't you?
I haven't for a long time. I haven't been down there for quite a while. And you need I'm overdue for a visit. He's overdue for a visit. He really is. He should come down with me. I should. We should make it a pilgrimage.
And I like to tease my lesbian friends that I'm the only lesbian that goes to Saints and Sinners to try and find gay men. But it's for the book club. Appreciate your spending time discussing. And again, the novels we discussed were Gods and Monsters, originally titled Father Frankenstein, and Eminent Outlaws.